Hello, and welcome to another episode of Boundless Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we have another amazing guest to reintroduce to you now. Dr. Peter Ballerstedt is a returning guest on our show. You can check out his first appearance on episode 62 of Boundless Body Radio. Dr. Peter Ballerstedt, also known as the Sodfather, Don Pedro, and the leader of the Ruminati, a group for those who understand the vital role of ruminant animals in humanity's past, present, and future, received his Bachelor of Science in Agriculture and Master of Science from the University of Georgia. He received his PhD from the University of Kentucky in 1986, specializing in forage management and utilization, minoring in ruminant nutrition. Peter is an advocate for ruminant animal agriculture and the essential role of animal source foods in the human diet. He strives to build bridges between producers and consumers and researchers across a wide variety of scientific disciplines. He is a member of several national and international scientific societies, participates in related global initiatives, and is the former president of the American Forage and Grassland Council. Peter's study of human nutrition led him to become an advocate for ruminant animal agriculture and the essential role of animal source foods in the human diet. Dr. Peter Ballerstedt, what an absolute honor it is to welcome you back to Boundless Body Radio.
Thank you, Casey, for the opportunity. It was great to see you recently in person, and always wonderful to have a chance to visit.
Yeah, it's really great to visit with you. It was great to see you again at the Collaborative Science Conference, which was great. I've seen you a few times between then, and you're always just so fun to catch up with and have such interesting things to present on, which I absolutely love. You know, before we kind of get into our topic today, maybe a few comments. What would you like to say about the COSI conference that we just got back from in Vegas, hosted by Dave Feldman, that he put on in Las Vegas?
Well, it was a wonderful event with some really important information and some moments that took place. The fact that it was such a successful fundraising opportunity, the work that you know, I hate to be the old man, you know, kind of, I remember when Dave first showed up, and, you know, so much has happened. It's really remarkable to watch. And I don't think it's hyperbole to say that if I look out the same number of years in the future as, you know, he's been on this journey, it's going to be quite remarkable the things that have come from the efforts that he's been able to kind of get organized and funded. And he's got now this group of collaborating researchers. So it was really, from that perspective, it was great to see some people like yourself that I hadn't seen for a while, but also new people coming in. Because, you know, every once in a while you can go to some events where, you know, we just keep talking to ourselves here. And it was great to see some new people come in and join the herd, you should pardon the expression.
No, I absolutely love that. As part of what I did for this conference is I set up interviews with people who had never been to a conference before, both before the conference and after the conference, so we could hear about what their expectations were and what the results were. And yeah, to hear about these people that were so lit up to be able to go, and then to hear like how amazing it was, they all just felt like they were rock stars and they got to talk to you and some of the other amazing people there. And I thought some of the citizens who made presentations, ones like kind of like you said, that you would never be able to see at a low carbohydrate conference, lay people that could apply to, you know, make presentations. I thought they did really, really well as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I'm always in their corner when anyone gets up and speaks for the first time. You know, it's like it's one of the scariest things people can think about doing. And when anybody does it, you know, you just want to encourage them. And then when they do it so well, you just want to tell them, good job. And again, I think that this is such good news. Metabolic health, the role of an effective lifestyle intervention in addressing so many really serious conditions. And of course, a serious condition is one I have, right? Versus one that, they're all serious, right? But if you sit back as I have and begin to try to look at sustainability on a societal or global scale, and you begin to see how this could play in addressing these issues on a global scale, it begins to just be, what can we possibly be missing here? Because this is clearly something we ought to be hearing more about and talking more about and getting more widely known.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it's equal parts so exciting and optimistic to hear that. And also at the same time, so difficult not to be pessimistic with the direction that things are going and how much we have to fight this from, pardon my expression, the grassroots kind of movement from the ground up, because understanding where the money is going and where it has been going for so long, it's definitely not something that's going to change top down anytime soon.
Yeah, I don't mean to minimize the essential role of more studies, more science, and at the same time, people who are trying to affect change from, policy top down. It's all important, but I don't think it's going to be sufficient, right? It's necessary, but not by itself sufficient. But if we're talking to people and we can say, here's the stack of refereed journal publications that support it here. And okay, yeah, we've just started. So the stack is only, and now I'm used, my hands are only 3 inches apart as opposed to 6 inches apart. There's a tremendous amount of information, and no, we're not going to hear about it, for it doesn't have to be a conspiracy. Right. It's completely explainable when you think. So for a while, I worked in the grass seed, forage seed industry. There are some varieties which were developed by a company. And so there are rules in place that say that nobody else can sell that variety by that name. Right. It's protected, which there's a tremendous investment in time and expense in developing these. There are other varieties which we call more commodity, right? So anybody can produce and sell them. And so those tend to be much lower price. There's no margin to support marketing, et cetera, et cetera. So I get that there has to be some, as I said, margin in the marketing of a product in order to support the, okay, I get that. Where's the margin to tell people, you just go to the store and buy this, don't buy that. And no, it doesn't have to be fancy. And you can go out and pick up something heavy. You can walk in your backyard out in the sunshine or whatever. I mean, and yes, that's probably going to be good enough for 80% of the population.
Yeah.
Plus or minus. I'm not going to say it's going to, everybody, right? I'm sure that there are specific situations where maybe you need to be more rigorous or what have you. But when we're dealing with what I just looked it up the other day, that, 60, it depends on how you want to look at it, of course. But when 93% of adult Americans don't exhibit optimal cardiometabolic health, right? When well over half of adult Americans have either diabetes or prediabetes. I mean, it is such a huge impact could be made. And then it just came up yesterday as I answered somebody's email. As long as we think of obesity as the cause of conditions, then it becomes, what's your solution to obesity? Well, you don't, eat less, don't exercise, move more, eat less, right? Okay. On the other hand, if you start saying obesity is a manifestation of metabolic derangement, and I take it a step further and I say malnutrition manifests itself differently across countries, across income level countries. So yes, you can be in very poor portions of a country or countries that are overall much lower income. And yes, you could see wasting, just caloric insufficiency. You could see kwashiorkor with the bloated belly and the skinny legs and arms, the sort of stereotypic symptoms of famine. On the other hand, obesity is malnutrition. And if we read, you know, books like Gary Taubes and others, we can see how there's been this evidence for decades. People have recognized that obesity associates more strongly with poverty than with, you know, affluence. And yet we talk about these as diseases of affluence or plagues of prosperity or whatever. And part of what I hope I will do, and I encourage others to do, is just think maybe about some of the words that we're using, right? And so I talked about that a little bit in Las Vegas, where, you know, it's very common to talk about nutrient-dense foods. And I just tried to point out that some people have a definition for that that might not be the same definition that you're using. Right. And so when you look at the dietary guidelines for 2020 to 2025, they were all about nutrient density. Make every bite count. You know, that was their big thing. But they explicitly defined nutrient dense foods as being low in fat, either added or naturally occurring. So it was lean meat. It was, you know, low fat dairy. And then they went through, you know, this bizarre exercise where they tried to show people what different versions of typical versus nutrient dense choice would be. So part of the challenge that I get involved with when I go to other parts of the world and we start talking about food systems is making sure people understand that, as I said in one paper, and the reviewer said, I had to look that word up. It's a good word. food is not univocal, right? It very much depends. And we need to be concerned about providing a higher quality diet for humanity. It's not merely calories. It's, you know, because we can be overfed but undernourished. And so what kinds of foods do people need to have access to, affordability, you know, produced in their areas, all those issues. But right now we still have this mindset that obesity is the result of overeating, sedentary behavior, that red meat somehow is harmful, that animal fats cause all of that conventional wisdom infests other disciplines.
Yep.
And so part of what I get to do is, depending on my audience, try to introduce them to information from some of my other tribes so that we can get ourselves maybe communicating more effectively and maybe making some better progress.
Well, I absolutely love that. And I love that your work has taken you to that place where you get to play and share your message in so many different kind of camps and attend different conferences with different messages. I do want to go to that slide that is absolutely hilarious that you showed, by the way, with the comparison of the nutrient dense and, you know, how you can make a food better. That was taken from the guidelines. So that was from the 2020 guidelines. Is that where that picture was from?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Can you give a few examples for the listener who didn't get to see that slide?
Sure. So they felt that they I forget how many examples. There are maybe five or six. And so you've got, you know, one that's the sort of typical version and then their better version, more nutrient dense. And so it starts on one side with frosted mini wheats as being the typical, and then the nutrient dense version would be unfrosted mini wheats. Okay. And then, you know, we skip over and we get to butter being the typical. Now, we could argue about how typical butter consumption is in the US anymore, but then their nutrient dense version, better choice, was vegetable oil.
Oh my goodness.
And then the one that just, you know, when you see it, you just cut. So the typical was soda. That was the typical. And then the nutrient dense choice was sparkling mineral water. You know, so and you wonder, I wonder, because these are intelligent people. I mean, so what must it be what forces are at work that you could have somebody who's intelligent, like, look at that and go, yeah, that's good. Okay. And go on and not go, what are we doing? How is that? You know, I mean, I like sparkling mineral water. As I say, it's one of my go-to choices, but I would not consider it nutrient dense. And you know how you give a talk and they say every time you give a talk, you give three. There's the one you plan to give, the one you give, and the one you think you should have given when you get done. And so in thinking about what I was going to say, I meant to reference people to one of Amber O'Hearn's presentations on nutrient density and how it can be less than useful. And yet I've had some pretty interesting interactions with people from my home tribes because they want to promote the nutrient density of a product produced this way versus another. And, you know, so I try to behave in a way that doesn't shut down future conversations, you know, so I hope I achieve that. But it really has been a distraction for us in many ways, and it'll continue to be until we can get the message more widely known that, you know, maybe a lot of this conversation has been because we've had these incorrect hypotheses, you know, these theories of what produced chronic illness. And one of the things that I find just so encouraging is this theory of hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance, is sort of a unifying theory, right? No longer do we have to have, you know, five different things that cause this and six different things that cause that and seven. And you know, at the end of the day, I forget, at one point, I think they still do it. Maybe it's NIH, maybe it's just the American Diabetes Association, I forget which, but they have a list of risk factors for pre-diabetes. And I've heard radio spots for this where they say, take this test and see and whatever. And well, you know, are you over a certain age? Are you a male? Do you have a family history? Well, tell me what you're going to do to alter any of those three things. And so then you get to one or two other things. So it's like three out of the five, you have no chance to moderate at all. And then the other two, they're going to give you at best ineffective advice about how to address those. And so it's like, that's really not a very hopeful message when you have people who are saying, oh, look, we've achieved drug-free remission in 50% of the patients who take part in this. And so I go to my ag community and I start talking to them about some of these things. And some of the people are like, yeah, well, you know, I have this or that or the doctor, whatever. And I, well, has your doctor talked to you about drug-free remission? Or, and it's like, no, it's like, well, why does it have to be an agronomist that brings this information to you? And that could work at several levels. So I really do think that this is an enormously hopeful message. And then I can talk to people about how, you know, we have evidence of people in other countries, in this country, integrating grazing animals into crop-producing systems and seeing benefits. And so, you know, you'll hear people say things about how we can't feed the world on this kind of diet or whatever. First reaction is, no, we must. We need to shift this conversation completely. You know, we've this is a moral imperative for those of us who have the opportunity to do this kind of work. But beyond that, I don't think people have fully understood, you know, some of the details that they constantly throw out about, you know, if we weren't using all this land to grow beef, then look at all the soybeans we could grow to feed people. And it's ridiculous because The vast majority of agricultural land is not suitable for crop production. But then you get to this idea that, oh, well, even on the crop producing land, we can do both. It doesn't have to be either or. And in fact, there is no either or. The animal agriculture is an essential part of sustainable food systems wherever in the world. And so we can do things better and we need to improve because, you know, I was just seeing something that said 20% of the meat that's produced every year is lost due to diseases in the animals. And a lot of this is just stuff that, you know, people in higher income countries have learned how to, you know, it's part of animal agriculture, you know, husbandry. So it's not like, yeah, and maybe in some cases we need to do new research, but in a lot of cases it's application of information that's already known. And so then you ask the question, why isn't it adopted? And we should look at all the reasons. But, you know, if you could get 20% more out of what you're already doing, that comes directly against the emissions intensities. Because the animal's already alive and living and emitting and doing all that, but you don't get to harvest the meat from those animals. And then you start to look at other comparisons, like I've been to Brazil on a couple of occasions. I have colleagues on both sides of my bridges there, which is really cool. I've got, you know, metabolic health people I've connected with, and I've got the agriculture people I've connected with, and I've gotten to connect them with each other. But Brazil has three times the cattle that we do, and they produce less beef. So if, you know, and in fact, the FAO put out a report within the last 6 months, maybe it's certainly within the last year, but basically they looked at all the things that could be done to impact emissions from animal agriculture globally. And like the lowest one on the list was dietary changes of humans. Wow. So, I mean, it's the thing that gets talked about the most and it has the least impact. Meanwhile, there are other things that if we had people who understood, no, animal source food is essential for proper human development and function. It's an essential part of many rural economies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then maybe we could find the resources to support the kind of work that would make meaningful impact in people's lives, environmental footprints, etc. Yeah. You know, the thing I like to point out is healthcare has a footprint.
That's right.
And I've been introduced to communities that are talking seriously about sustainability, and they say we have to look at many factors, not just one. You know, there are no solutions. There's only trade-offs, right? And so it's this interaction between all these things, but you can bucket some of these factors into societal, economic, as well as environmental. And I have one slide where, you know, there are like 24 factors just within an environmental, wow, you know, sort of bucket. But frequently we only look at emissions, right? One out of that bucket. And so I just want to point out, what's the cost of chronic illness in direct and indirect? And then, you know, what's the societal impact of people's lives being diminished because they can't be as active or as long-lived, or they don't, you know, whatever. And then there's an actual environmental impact of healthcare. And there have been a couple studies that I cite every time I get the chance. And just because we don't look at that. In fact, anytime they talk about sustainable healthcare, well, maybe that's not quite fair, but the vast majority of time they talk about sustainable healthcare, it comes with the implicit understanding of what is a healthy diet. Mm. So it's sustainable because if people eat less meat, they'll be healthier. And then, and it's like, wait a minute, that's a big leap there. How about if, just let's speculate wildly, how about if we could eliminate medication use? Oh, Okay, so let's just speculate that it's possible. I'm being sarcastic. Let's imagine that if the average adult American with type 2 diabetes could eliminate their medication use, they would reduce their carbon footprint 29% more than if they shifted from a high meat to a vegan diet. And anytime anyone talks about dietary impacts, remember, this is for the rest of your life. And so you may get people to adopt a vegan diet, but the vast majority of people do not stay on a vegan diet.
That's right.
And yet we can have drug-free remission of type 2 diabetes and goodness knows how many associated conditions, right? I mean, that's the whole thing. We're talking about metabolic syndrome and a constellation of manifestations. All of those, it's worth trying. I get excited, obviously. I think ruminant animal agriculture is just this really phenomenal thing, past, present, future. You know, there's little tidbits you can throw out. But people haven't gotten enough of the story.
Yeah.
And they're making decisions, which are understandable why you would make that decision. So how can we communicate more of this story so people have that? So that's why I'm always happy to have conversations and I'm always open to how I can be doing things better.
Yeah, well, we certainly appreciate that, and getting that information out there is so important. The Netflix series Drive to Survive got me into the sport of Formula One, and I really love watching the races and all that stuff. And there's a real push in Formula One for sustainability. So for example, they've been talking about the blankets that sit over the tires that keep the tires at a certain temperature. They're thinking about lowering and lowering and lowering the temperature of the blankets of the tires for the 13 sets of tires that these drivers are going to use over a weekend. And starting in 2026, there's going to be some quote unquote like sustainable fuel that the cars will be running on. So we're going to ship essentially a giant event around the planet that hosts 400,000 people over a weekend, and we're going to change the temperature of the tire blankets. On that note, that's not a bad thing. That's an okay thing. But compare what you were just telling us about the healthcare impact on things like emissions versus if some certain people got what they wanted today and were able to like eliminate all ruminant animals, cows in particular, what does that future actually truly look like? And what kind of like unintended consequences would come from that?
Well, so... years ago, I got from a colleague, Frederick Lois in Belgium, and he gave me three things. One, animal source food is essential for public health. And it's, by my perspective, defendable to say that humanity's existential crisis today is insufficient animal source food. We have far more and far higher quality evidence of human beings being harmed by not enough. And anything that people think is evidence of too much is usually the product of nutritional epidemiology of chronic disease and whatever and whatever. Number two is that livestock agriculture in general, ruminants in particular, are essential for sustainable food systems. Full stop. Number three is that these are ancestral foods. They're part of our heritage, regardless of where that comes from. And so we've got this weird situation where these wealthy, mostly Westerners are coming at the rest of the world saying, no, you need to stop doing that. So those are the three things. I could point to estimates like Hall and White, and I forget the year, relatively recently. They said, what would be the impact of eliminating animal agriculture in the United States? And so what they ended up with is saying, we'd be looking at something like 2.5% reduction in anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., 0.4% global, 0.4% global. But again, there's no solutions, there's only trade-offs. And they said it would come at the price of imbalancing our food system and They said creating, I would say, exacerbating essential nutrient deficiencies. Already in the US and the UK, we've got something like a fifth of women of childbearing age being anemic. That's in the US. You know, it's something. There was just a recent estimate that said that more than a fifth of adults in the United States are likely not meeting their essential amino acid requirements. And that's sort of on the low end of the estimate. You know, we have evidence of essential micronutrient deficiencies globally. I could go into more detail. It's a real thing present today. And again, it looks different, this malnutrition. We need to broaden our understanding of that. You know, half of the world's cattle live in Asia and Africa. Like two-thirds to three-quarters of the sheep live in Africa and Asia. Like 90-plus percent of the world's goats live in Africa and Asia. So we're entertaining conversations in the high-income Western countries, which, when they affect things in the developing and middle, you know, low-income, middle-income countries, have a negative effect. And you can see it because we have funding agencies that won't fund that work because everybody knows we need to be cutting down on animal, you know. So these things are already having an effect. I remember Georgia Ede years ago giving me the factoid that 95% of the world's vegetarians are economic vegetarians. They're not philosophical vegetarians. In other words, they would eat more animal source food if they had access to it. And so what we have is people being harmed in low and middle income countries because of a lack of access, a lack of affordability. We have people in the high income countries being harmed because of choices that are being made because of poor information and what have you. The harms will end up looking the same. You know, we have people doing really good work to try to improve the nutrition of children in the first 1,000 days of development, which is critical for brain development, which is critical because if you don't do that right, you can't make it up for the rest of their life. And so you have people like the WHO saying that animal source foods, meat, eggs, dairy, seafood, are the best, if not sole source of the nutrients that are essential for proper brain development in children 6 months to 23 months of age. UNICEF says that 60% of the world's children aged 6 months to 23 months do not get meat, eggs, dairy, seafood. So, you know, I look at stuff like that and it just reinforces this imperative nature of us getting this right. And there are different people working at different parts of that. And part of mine is just to get more people aware of these things. I mean, how can you look at the fact that between a fifth and a quarter of children under 5 years old globally are stunted due to a lack of these essential nutrients? And stunting, most importantly, refers to impaired brain development. And so these are human beings that won't be able to achieve their potential because of how they were fed. And sometimes, we now have evidence of during, you know, pregnancy and even before pregnancy, because, you know, body stores, we talk about it in animal agriculture, right? We want the dam to have sufficient body stores to support a healthy pregnancy and then be able to come back into cycle within a time frame to allow, you know, optimal from an economic point of view, reproduction, right? So a cow takes about 9 months gestation, and then we want her to rebreed, be pregnant again in about 3 months. right? Because we need that mama cow to be giving us a calf, and not just birth, but we want her to wean that calf successfully, right? That's the hope of any profitable and sustainable system. So we've learned a lot about fetal imprinting. We've learned about pre-pregnancy nutrition and getting developing females to where they can breed so that they can produce their first calf at 2 years of age, right? I mean, all of these sorts of things. And so there's some overlap. There's part of the wonder of ruminants is there is no feed food competition, regardless of what people say. The vast majority, we're talking 96% of what the world's ruminant animals consume, domestic ruminant animals consume, is not human edible. And then that remaining bit, one could argue whether just because we can, should we? Right. I mean, the fact that I can feed grain to a ruminant and have meat and milk produced, I think that's a really good deal because I'm not real big on eating the grain, but other people differ. So, okay. But without understanding that difference, I have a working definition of agriculture, which is basically the story of agriculture is man's manipulation of his environments to produce more biomass than would normally occur under the natural conditions. Mm. I put air quotes around natural because some people don't think humans are part of nature. And the vast majority of that biomass that's produced is not human edible. So even if I produce a crop of wheat or a crop of corn, over half of that biomass in that crop isn't human edible. Well, what am I going to do with it? I think it's a great idea that I can run it through a ruminant and achieve, you know, some product out of that. There was one study in Europe that said that for every, they said kilo, it would be the same to say pound, of vegan food produced, that was their term, they produced 4 to 5 kilos or pounds of inedible biomass. You know, so a lot of byproduct feed gets fed to ruminants in the United States. So there's a large almond industry in California, and almond hulls get fed to dairy cows as a fiber source, as a feed resource. My line is you can't get milk from almonds, but you can get it from almond hulls.
There you go.
So all of that has to be part of any serious conversation about sustainable or circular systems. Is we're getting maximum value out of what's being produced, and then we can talk about how to adjust systems to make sure that we have nutrients that are being captured within the system and not subject to, you know, loss and pollution or impacts that way. There's a system underway in Brazil where basically, and this is an example I give frequently, they grow soybeans. That's the cash crop. That's the money crop, which is causing great problem. I mean, grassland, natural grasslands in the world are our most endangered biomes, far more than tropical rainforest. And even in Brazil, same thing. But, you know, some biomes have better PR agencies, I guess.
Yeah, apparently.
So what's happening there is you're finding a lot of the native grassland being converted into soybean production, right? Because they can, you know, the owner can make more leasing the ground to someone who's going to come in and do all the farming. They can make more from what they pay in rent than they could producing beef themselves from the same land. So there's certain economics at work here. Other places, so they're growing soybeans. At about the time they're going to harvest the soybeans, they plant a winter annual grass forage that they then graze with weaned cattle to put several hundred more pounds on before they go somewhere else before it's time to then plant soybeans again the next year. Okay. So it's the cash crop. That's where all their inputs go. That's the old thinking. Somebody said, what if we put the fertilizer on the forage instead of the soybeans? And what they found was they produced more forage. Unsurprisingly, you fertilize it, you get more. Okay. And because they produced more forage, they produced more beef. Okay. But then because about 90% of the nutrients that a cow consumes is going to go back onto the land. So now that fertility is there for the soybeans. So they produce the same soybean yield. Plus, they got whatever benefit they got out of a more vigorous grass stand growing through that fall, winter, and spring period. Same inputs, same area, greater yields, some benefits. We need to find all of those kinds of applications everywhere in the world and appropriate to those areas, right? But this is the sort of work that could be done. But again, to a certain extent, some of this is limited because everyone knows that soybean oil is healthy. So, you know, or whatever, you know, that red meat's bad for you. And so it's really good that I know so many physicians that I can say, oh, I'm an agronomist. I don't know this stuff, but these people say,
oh, that's great.
Maybe having higher LDL cholesterol isn't like the kiss of death. Maybe.
That's right. Wow. Well, I'm glad you explained it in that way because we do get so short-sighted in the things that we learn and the numbers that we hear. And I think the word that you used that I relate with the most is the trade-offs. Like we talk about methane, we don't talk about land. We talk about land, we don't talk about water. Like there's so many factors to all of this, and the plants need the animals and the fertilizer and vice versa. We need all of it. And it's a really cool example that you shared where the animals are making everything better, and that's helping regardless of whether you're eating the soybeans or whether you're eating the cow. It all of it is improving together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, many times people, you know, they only know what they hear, right, or what they're exposed to. So I'm perfectly understanding why people would be concerned about their health. I mean, I'm going to now borrow from Lierre Keith. You know, it's completely reasonable for somebody to be concerned about their health. It's completely reasonable for somebody to be concerned about the environment. It's completely reasonable for somebody to be concerned about animal welfare. It's completely reasonable for people to be concerned about other people in society. If you combine those reasonable concerns with bad information, you can make bad decisions. And I think that's what we've been seeing over the last several decades. And you and I and people that we know have done a really good job of telling us how some of those that information got developed and then distributed for people to take and go, oh, well, low fat is healthy. You know, I want something low cholesterol. Well, you put those two things together, that pretty well rules out the whole animal kingdom. And so I was having a conversation with someone the other day, and he was amazed that a difference between animal cells and plant cells is that plant cells have a wall. Animal cells have a membrane. And so that was like, well, that's like basic sort of biology for us. And yet I'm not saying this to cast aspersions on them. I'm just saying some of us have been working in certain areas and there's a certain amount of, you know, background to that. And we don't think about that. But part of what I try to say to my forage community is there's a whole lot of people that are really interested in what you do. They don't know you exist.
Yep.
They wouldn't know to come. They wouldn't know to look for you. You know, and so how do we get better at reaching out? Because, you know, if you're working to support agriculture in the United States, there's only about 2%. Of the population that's your audience, right, as production agriculture. Now, in certain parts of the country, obviously, that's going to be bigger, right? If you're in the middle of Nebraska, okay, as opposed to being in New York City. We all eat. It's all important. But those of us who have been trained to serve the one audience, I think we have information that more people would be available. So one of the things I talked about in Las Vegas was that there is, well, let me take a step back. I have a real personal interest because of my experience in the areas of recovery from alcoholism and addiction, and also mental health. Again, one of the lines that I didn't use in Las Vegas is, alcoholism and mental illness don't run in my family, they gallop. So I can look back a couple generations and see the evidence in branches of my family. So part of the real hope that I see is people like the Bazooki Group and Metabolic Mind and Georgia Ead and Chris Palmer. I mean, this is information that, again, more people need to be aware of. From those communities of recovery, I've learned certain things. And the question then is there something from those communities that I can practice in this realm, right? And so the idea that we may be the only example of this that somebody's ever going to see, right? So make it a good example, right? Think about how we're acting towards others, how we speak about others, and don't chase anybody away. Right. Just what can we do to be more welcoming? You know, none of us came. I don't know about you, Casey. I started in this space around 2007. So where I am today is not where I was then. I hope where I am today is not where I was last year. I mean, I hope there's so when somebody new comes along, let's not like crank open the nozzle on the fire hose and give them the full blast. Right. Let's find ways to welcome people in and people to direct them to who can help them start climbing the learning cliff that we're all familiar with. And so one of the things that has come to my awareness is I worked in something called the Cooperative Extension Service as the Extension Forage Specialist in Oregon. A lot of my colleagues in the American Forage and Grassland Council also are part of the Extension Service. This is a really unique American institution, and it's part of another unique American institution called the Land Grant University System. And so I could give a lot more detail, but basically anyone in the United States can go to their county and find the office of the Extension Service that serves their community. Now you can go there and get information about gardening and food preservation and any number of other things. If you have some strange disease on your apple tree, you can frequently take in some leaves and say, what is this? And they'll tell you and give you lots of information, free or very low cost. If you ask them for dietary information, I can tell you what you're going to get. My suggestion is this is something that we could all start like going in and become known to these people and maybe find somebody in there that maybe even has our own experience. You know, maybe I'm sure that there are people in these offices that have experienced a therapeutic carbohydrate reduction, ketogenic diet, and you know, you might start on the ag and natural resources side of the house and not the human performance side, just because of things that I could talk about. But over time, get known. And then at some point, we might be able to start saying, yeah, I know that dietary guideline information, that's for a healthy diet for people to stay healthy. I understand. I understand it all. But that's the story. Okay, but they themselves say that this is not intended for the treatment of disease. That's a statement that's occurred in the last three editions. I can't believe it's not going to be in the next one. Okay, so my agronomist view of that is they're saying, eat this way, you won't get sick. But if you get sick, don't eat this way. Okay. So what is the burden of, let's merely start with type 2 diabetes or whatever we can build in our community as we go to this organization that's intended to serve the community and say, we have this massive problem with diabetes in this area, and we can trundle out all the, what information do you have for that? Okay, that it begins the conversation, and then back and forth, and how could we contribute to that? Because the Extension Service was always meant to be a two-way communication from the land-grant university to the people of the state and from the local communities within that state back up to the land-grant university. Mm. So you live in Las Vegas?
I'm in Salt Lake City, just outside.
I'm sorry. So Utah State University is your land-grant university. Mm. And so we could look up where the Cooperative Extension Office is in Salt Lake City. You know, so and so that's something. And then there's plans afoot for a more concerted program where we actually launch pilot programs. Because in the past, I am aware of one approach being we facilitate meetings with the diabetes educators that come in, right? So Extension is providing some support for that, and we could talk into that space as well. And if we can bring metabolic health practitioners, professionals, right, not an agronomist, right, into that for that local, that one office, and then document, okay, this is the reach that this has had across our community. This is the impact it's had on the people that participated. Show us your data for some other approach. And just try to push that information back upstream. I'm optimistic. I'm not naive. I know it's a minefield. I know where some of the mines exist. There are undoubtedly others. But at this point, what else can I do? This seems to make the most sense for the reasons that I've already talked about during our visit.
Yeah. Well, very interesting. Have you personally had success with doing that? Like going to your own, or when you've been traveling and talking to some of these people, has that come to fruition in your experience?
My experience so far has been the one-on-one with people who are part of. Yeah, you know, there's a certain part of this. Here, take my advice. I'm not using it. but now that I'm retired, right, that possibility opens up. And also, I live in Benton County, Oregon. That's where the land-grant university is located. The further away from the land-grant you get, you might have different results. Mm. Right. Like I say, I'm optimistic. I'm not naive. We tried this from the top down, we being a colleague and I. We put together a proposal pretty much like this and got a really good response from the dean. And then we met with the two directors, one of whom was more from the ag side, and they were concerned about the wheat growers. And the other side was the human performance side, and they were very excited. They took it back to their faculty, who basically said, ain't no, but hell no. Right. So it was a very interesting introduction to the space. A classmate of mine ended up far more successful than I, and he ended up being the dean for his state. He said, Pete, I believe you. I've seen it myself. I see it in my wife. You want me to put the salary of half my faculty at risk?
Wow. Wow.
So this is why I think we need to take a step back and go, okay, that's the reality of what, but is there a way to, okay, you say that you're about science-based information, you say you're about, you know, evaluating these programs to address local need. As I started off, here's the science. Okay, we'll put that on the table and just let you know that exists. So whatever you're going to say about science-based, you're going to have to deal with this. Okay, but let's not do that in a way that says, you know, that is more confrontational than is absolutely required.
Yeah.
And let's say, we have these things being demonstrated under these conditions. Can we demonstrate them under our conditions? Yeah. And meanwhile, hopefully we're talking to more one-on-one, and you never know where those seeds will find the right ground to sprout and grow and yield on.
Yeah.
That's what we're going to be spending more time on, as well as just making sure that as much as I can, I get the message into literature from other disciplines.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. No, I think about that conference in particular, and you have a bunch of people who are very, very lit up about this stuff, spent 2 days together, all the love and energy, and everybody's together, and everybody there wants to go share this message. And yet what I see on like the Facebook forums of people that are trying a low carbohydrate diet and people are telling people they're not doing it right, or they're not carnivoring enough or whatever. It's like, you know, we could do much better as a community building more bridges. I love what you said about being optimistic, but naive. I understand that most of us don't have a huge platform that we can create massive amounts of change, but you can in your own little world. And that those ripples, like you talk about, that makes a difference.
Absolutely. And what's the option, right? You know, you could be optimistic or you could be a pessimist. Well, you know, the one comes with a penalty, and the one, you know, we might be disappointed or we might be surprised. You know, I remember that there are the Eeyores in life, right? That just, oh, it's terrible. Oh, poor me, or whatever, you know, and depending on our life experience, you know, we sort of get beaten up over long enough, and that affects how we look at things. But this person one time just said, what if it's wonderful? What if it's awesome? You know, so, but that's not where some of our brains go right off the bat. You know, it's like, oh, this is going to be terrible. It's going to suck. It's going to hurt. You know, I'm going to, you know, force myself to it's like talking to people about how this is such a restrictive diet. Well, let's see. We've got the steak with hollandaise sauce. We've got the, you know, I don't find it restrictive. I don't know. Maybe I'm different that way. I keep thinking that somewhere in the course of our experience, we'll run into the right person who's just had to deal with a parent or a spouse going through, you know, Alzheimer's or some long-term progressively degenerative condition. And they, for the first time, well, it would be like the Bazookies, right? It would be like the Charlie Foundation folks, and I'm sorry I don't remember their names, but this idea that you've been struggling under the conventional wisdom and the conventional approach, and all of a sudden somebody like somehow introduces you to this information that affects this massive change, and all of a sudden they're off and doing something in a way that you weren't equipped for that. You weren't in the right place. You didn't have the right resources. You didn't even think about it. And all of a sudden, bang, you know, I keep thinking that we'll run into those people as we get more and more people aware of this really essential information. And so part of my message is when you improve your health, you are improving the world. Right. In ways that are deeply meaningful to your community, certainly to your family, certainly to you. I mean, how does, you know, having better health affect how you look at the world you're in? So all of these things, and when you look at what we're being told we need to do to affect that kind of change, and you realize how meaningless that would be as opposed to this approach. And you start going, wow, this is it's like Dr. Unwin's, would you like lifetime medication or lifestyle intervention? Mm-hmm. And how few people say, yeah, I believe I'd like that lifetime medication, please. You know, especially when you explain that, oh, okay, we'll do this for a while and then we'll have to add this because that'll start doing, you know. So anybody who's had this experience, that message to someone else, and whether it's a church community or it's some book club or it's, you know, a civic organization or it's just your neighborhood, those are all places. And then one of the things I talked about, and I got it from my wife. So I remember when Good Calories, Bad Calories came out. And Nancy was aware of it first because she was aware of all this before I was. And so she put her name on the list when it showed up at the library. And but she wasn't able to finish it in the 1 week because it was a new book. So it was only a 7 day that you're allowed to have it. So she had to like turn it back in twice more before she could get it all read. I'm the kind of guy that goes, hello, Amazon. So there's a fundamental difference between the two of us. Okay. But what she showed me is here, at least in Benton County, the Corvallis Benton County Library, they have a process whereby she can say, could you buy this book? And I'm not even aware of all the details, but I'm aware that she's done it so long now that they know her, and they know because the books that she gets them to buy have almost immediately a waiting list for them.
Great.
Right? Because other people want them, right? So she's like demonstrated that her opinion is something to pay attention to. So I don't know what that process is for other places to get books into libraries or to encourage them to buy books. But now that she's done that, there are copies of those books that other people can go and read.
That's awesome.
So what other ways are there for us to do that kind of stuff? Maybe we could begin to, you know, if we're involved in the school system, what are they teaching? How could we affect change there? There are things like 4-H and FFA and those sorts of programs. Where does their information come from? How could we maybe get information into those curricula and are there, I know that there are young people in agriculture kind of groups scattered around the world, the country. How could we get this info, you know, because we know, yes, we know young people are bulletproof. So whatever, but you know, it wouldn't hurt to get this information there because they're probably going to tell somebody. Yep. And how do we plug into those? But again, how can we become more effective? If every man's an island, our job is to paddle around until we find the right beach to land on. But, you know, at some point we need to get the multipliers involved. So don't neglect the one. And as we're engaging the multipliers, it's kind of that thing. We need to find the right way to make that connection with them so that then they can do what they know how to do and, you know, continue to support them and all that. So really left Las Vegas encouraged, informed. My heart was full. I kept saying to people as I was leaving, because a lot of these people I've now known for several years, so it's great to see them again. But also to feel like we're not merely talking to the same people again and again. Right. So that was, and it was great to listen to that interaction that you had with them. And that was a brilliant idea to talk to them before and talk to them after. That was really good.
Well, thanks, man. I just think it's such a great call to all of us that whatever space we're in, we can be that light. We can be that example. We can try to be creative, as you suggest, to try to find different ways to make those bridges and to help share this message and get it out there with whatever angle, like you said, will really work with people. And I love your optimistic attitude and just great big smile. It was so great to see you in person. And yeah, I definitely left the conference with that same kind of vibe of, okay, we can affect change where we need to, and let's just keep plugging away and doing the work and make it genuine and authentic and really optimistic to help people out there. So again, Peter Ballerstedt, it's just such an honor to have you on the show. I promise you it's not going to be 3 years until the next time I ask you to come back, if that's okay. But for now, where would you like people to go to find you and connect with you and your work?
I'm all over social media. Grass-based, one word, is on Instagram and Twitter, or sorry, X. You can find Grass-based Health on Facebook. I have a Substack, ruminati.substack.com. Certainly all over YouTube. So I'm not hard to find. There's not that many Peter Ballerstedts around. There are some, but don't, you know, the bicycle decathlete from Germany is not me. haven't met him yet in person, but I keep seeing him pop up every once in a while. Appreciate the opportunity. We should remember that in order for darkness to win, it has to extinguish every light. Like any light at all overcomes the darkness.
Love that.
Right? And you know, it costs your candle nothing to light another candle.
Love that.
So thank you for the opportunity. If anything ever comes up that I can help you in what you're doing, please don't hesitate to reach out.
Well, thank you very, very much. And likewise to you, I doubt there's much I could do for you, but I love the work you're doing for myself and everybody else in the community. You're such an example out there. So thank you so very much for everything you do. And thank you for taking the time out of your very busy life to be on our show today. We really appreciate you.
And be well.
Likewise. And this has been another episode of Boundless Body Radio. As always, thank you so very much for listening to Boundless Body Radio. Hosting this podcast is seriously one of the most meaningful and joyous parts of my life. Even after 600 episodes of our show, I still get nervous before every interview that I do. But it does just bring me such joy to share some of my favorite people, the people that have taught me so much over the years, and to invite them on and ask them questions, and then to share that with you, the listener, is a super cool experience. I hope you've enjoyed the content of the show so far this year. I tried to start the year off with a mix of new guests and returning guests, some that are practically household names in the health and wellness space, and some inspiring people that may not be very well known now, but are certainly doing amazing work wherever they are. I'm just so grateful for all of our incredible guests. Remember that you can always go to our website to book a complimentary 30-minute session with us at myboundlessbody.com. On our homepage, one of the first things you'll see is a Book Now button where you can select a time to speak with us about your personal health and fitness plan. We don't have any set packages, products, supplements, or anything like that to sell you. People that do want to work with us simply pay for the time that they want, and that's about it. We've loved chatting with so many of you out there to bounce ideas off each other and try to offer any advice that we can. And seriously, as always, even if you book a spot just to say hello and introduce yourself, we absolutely love connecting with you, the listener, in our community. Be sure to check out our YouTube channel, which is also growing quite a bit, if you want to watch these full interviews and also shorter videos on more specific topics taken from these interviews as well. It's a fun way to interact with people who comment. We read and reply to every single YouTube comment we get, so be sure to subscribe to our channel and leave as many comments as you like. And of course, if you haven't already, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple. It is still the best way to make sure that the podcast gets out to more listeners. It only takes a moment to leave a review, and it's extremely meaningful to us. Cheers, and thank you again for listening to Boundless Body Radio.